This episode of Commentary, Trek Stars, is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 9 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And today is Part 4 in our series on Ira Stephen Baer as a showrunner, where we look at Baer's fifth series, Crash. 2007. The 4400 is cancelled. From what I understand, Ira Stephen Baer was not exactly happy by the fact that 4400 was canceled. It sounds like he was planning on doing a lot of other things, and this was upsetting to him. And it also left him without a writing gig. So that's how it stayed for a year, until 2009, when Stars came to him about Crash. But let's take a step back first. 2005. Paul Haggis, the writer of movies such as Million Dollar Baby and Flags of Our Fathers, and the I think he ran Walker, Texas Ranger for a while there. He writes and directs. I guess he wrote it with another guy, Bobby Moreno, I think. He writes and directs a movie called Crash. It's a movie about various people living in L.A. whose lives intersect with one another. There's a lot of it is about race relations and whatnot, and it's a bunch of stories, and at various times they crash into each other and change their lives for one reason or another.
And built on the conceit that different ethnicities live in completely different worlds,
mm-hmm.
and their lives don't intersect or overlap in any way. People might talk to them in a professional context, but everyone lives in their own reality. And the only way to get people from different ethnicities to be involved with each other is for there to be an unforeseen event like a car accident.
Well, sometimes
their lives to intersect in a significant way.
Sometimes it's a car accident. Sometimes it's other things, you know.
Well, I think the idea is that it's a collision, like the collision of mm-hmm. cultures.
Yes.
And it's literalized with the car accident.
Mm-hmm.
Well, accidents.
Yeah.
In the movie and show. Yeah. So mainly the question is it good at depicting these issues?
I guess that is a question, and the answer, according to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, is yes,
yeah,
because Crash won Best Picture for the 2005 awards season, and it starred Don Cheadle and Sandra Bullock and a bunch of other people. Brendan Fraser is in there, yeah. Terrence Howard, Marina Sirtis is in there. Somewhere, buried in there. What are your thoughts on Crash, the movie?
There are a lot of problems with this movie, but most of them are simple problems that are like common to a lot of movies, especially Oscar bait movies. There's a lot of the same sort of things being hit. It's about like cultural problems and social unrest, and it deals with these issues in a way that makes people frustrated and upset at the way the world is, and they want things to change. And this movie presents a very ridiculously stupid version of how to change things, which is essentially, hey, everybody, be nice. And that the way that they depict it in the film is essentially, it actually, by virtue of reducing all of the various conflicts down to, like, not only an overly simplified version of them, but in many ways a radical departure from what actually is occurring in the real world. Like, they so mischaracterize race relations that their responses actually end up seeming, to me at least, to be actually racist. The way that some of these race relations are dealt with nicely ends up being very oddly dismissive of the actual concerns. And that bothered me about the movie a lot. The idea that this was trying to be something like to end racism, but it actually felt very much like we are trying to make racism much harder to fight because we like it. We like our categories. We like our labels. We like the way this world works. And like, there are lots of ridiculous stereotypes in that movie. It's very upsetting.
I guess I didn't hate it as much as you did. I didn't like it. I thought that it was a little too scattered, and I thought that it was overly melodramatic, and I think that a lot of the things like the racism in the movie are dealt with in, like you were saying, kind of a simplified fashion, which made it kind of pointless. I remember getting kind of excited when it was announced that there was going to be a director's cut released. And there was initially a report coming out that it was going to be about 20 minutes shorter than the actual film. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, wow, if that's accurate, that could actually make that movie good. I could see trimming 20 minutes out of that movie and making it a good movie. In reality, it ended up being 3 minutes longer. Yeah. I never saw the director's cut. I did go back and watch it after it won Best Picture, because I felt like perhaps I had missed something. Perhaps I had seen it when I was in a bad mood. I didn't know. But what I did know was that 2005, to me anyway, was the best year for movies of the decade. And the idea that Crash won Best Picture is absolutely crazy.
I'm trying to think of something else that came out that year, and like the only thing that's popping in my head, and I'm not even sure this is right, is Brokeback Mountain.
2005, we had Batman Begins, okay. Star Wars Episode III, Revenge of the Sith,
okay,
Domino, Sin
this
City.
Sounds terrible so far. All of this sounds awful.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Maybe
this really sounds like a terrible year for movies.
Good Night and Good Luck.
Okay, I mean, so that one's totally good.
Maybe movies that you don't like. Fantastic, but they're movies that I like.
That's too bad.
Okay, regardless.
You shouldn't like those things.
Anyway, Crash was definitely not one of the best movies of that year. That, for me, was the end of it. Yeah, I mean, the other thing about it that I kind of hated, and I know that this goes outside of the movie itself, and is just sort of the attention that it was getting, and the idea that people were like, this is so great because it shows these stories and the way that they intersect in L.A. and blah, 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 and all this stuff. And I'm like, this feels to me a lot like Magnolia, only a hell of a lot worse than Magnolia. I know that you're not a fan, but I love Magnolia. And to me, Crash is like a B-grade Magnolia.
I wouldn't disagree with that. No. Magnolia is not good. And Crash is a dumber version of that.
Yeah, I agree with the second part for sure. Anyway, obviously, since it won Best Picture and since it was released by Lionsgate, and they're not known for turning out Best Pictures, they're known for turning out, now Tyler Perry movies, Hunger Games movies, Twilight movies, whatever Jason Statham is starring in, and in terms of their DVD catalog, at least 2 to 3 versions of Terminator 2 Judgment Day, which is arguably okay, probably the best thing in their catalog. So Crash wins Best Picture, is extremely popular, so of course, what do? You turn it into a TV show. Which, on paper, I can see,
no.
As far as movies are concerned,
no, what you just said is ridiculous.
I could see how a Crash show could translate to the television medium fairly easily.
No. What you're saying right now is literally crazy.
I'm not saying that it would be good. I'm just saying I can see how you could turn that into a show. I can see how you could say, like, this is a thing. We can turn it into this other thing. If that makes sense to me.
Okay. Fine.
So in 2008...
I think that sounds insane.
Okay. So in 2008, Glenn Mazzara, who would go on to run The Walking Dead in seasons, what, 2 and 3? He's the guy who was hired after they fired Frank Darabont.
Yes, he was one of the... He briefly occupied the showrunner chair at The Walking Dead before they started the music again, and he had to pick up a chair.
Basically, for those people who don't know, the way that showrunning on Walking Dead works is they get someone in there, he's hugely successful, they fire him, hire someone else who is also hugely successful, and fire him.
Yes, and oddly enough, they've actually been promoting from within for a while now.
So Mazzara, I haven't seen his stuff on Walking Dead. Would you say that it's quality stuff?
Sure. Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
Okay.
The Walking Dead is not a transcendently fantastic show.
But he's okay.
It's competently done.
He's a solid writer.
Yeah.
Okay. So he's brought in, he creates this show, Crash, for Starz. And it's interesting in that it's not a remake of the movie. That's not the same characters. It's basically taking this idea and saying, well, let's look at different characters. Let's take the concept and kind of expand on that and say, like, this is a movie about people in LA and their lives colliding with each other. Let's do that, but now with different characters and just explore those things over the span of 13 hours instead of 2 hours. So what did you...
I gotta tell you, that's... think about what you're saying here. Like, the lives of these characters, they occupy different realities. Their little cultures are separated from each other, like, by lifestyle, but not by space. Like, and they intersect when, like, these collisions occur, these cultural collisions, and sometimes it happens literally in the form of a car accident, which is the show's, like, main way of getting these characters together. That sounds insane. And it is.
I guess...
It is insane.
I guess what I'm just saying is, like, if you have that idea, if you think that idea works as a movie, the idea of expanding on that for the small screen, I think, is interesting. It's similar to what they did with the Traffic miniseries post movie.
I'm not arguing the like adaptation logic. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that by doing this thing, they made a show that does not make logical sense as a TV show from week to week. The first episode of this show features, like, the first collision.
It does, yeah.
That doesn't make sense.
It's, you know, that's a device. I mean, and we can get into that in a second. But I guess what I'm saying, what appeals to me about it is kind of like what we were talking about a couple weeks ago with The Twilight Zone, which is, like, even though it doesn't have anything to do with the movie, there's no reason to say that these things aren't happening in the same universe. You know, there's no reason to say that Marina Sirtis isn't somewhere in this TV world and that maybe one day we'll see her pop up in the show, perhaps during sweeps. Maybe not Marina Sirtis, but maybe Don Cheadle.
What you're saying, I think, is part of what I think the problem of the show is. Like, on a very basic level, like, I got this weird sort of impression when the movie came out, which was, like aside from feeling insulted by the film, aside from, you know, feeling that they have mischaracterized all of, you know, American, like, race relations in this one movie, I also felt like they were making a big deal out of something that was just normal now. The idea that you don't focus your work, your fiction, on, like, one race. Like, if you've got all white guys in there, you've screwed up, because it's just not how the world is anymore. Like, if you live in a city, you deal with a lot of different races on a regular basis. It would be weird if you didn't have like some black people and some Hispanic people and some Asian people involved in your story that features a white guy.
Yeah,
and they made such a big deal about how this was a thing, and it's like that's just not life anymore.
Yeah,
like this is normal now. Like this idea of like a movie where you have all these different people, that's just reality. You don't need to have a plot device because that's just not actually how the world works anymore.
And we can get into that in a second too. Now, I guess like the big star in the TV show was Dennis Hopper. He played a music executive, and there were a number of other, you know, people in the show as well, some that you'd recognize, some that you wouldn't. So what were your thoughts on the first season of Crash?
Terrible show.
Okay.
Basically unwatchable.
Okay.
Not only terrible as, like, you know, bad drama, like these characters are boring and what's going on is stupid. Terrible as in, like, this show's attempt to deal with race relations is making it really hard to not become a racist, because they seem really dead set on making you believe that like all the stereotypes that you have ever been exposed to are all true, and they're much worse than they seem to be, because every character in the show really molds very comfortably onto a racial stereotype. It's very disturbing. When I was watching it, I was like infuriated that this was not vilified. Like people responded to this show like saying like, oh, it's not very good. It's kind of a stupid show. It sucks. And no one was saying this is an incredibly racist show because these people are not thinking about what they're doing. They are trying to deal with racism in a stupid way, and they are actually making it worse.
I guess I can kind of see that. I think some of that comes from just sort of like clunky writing, especially early on. Like there is a thing which happens here, which, you know, you've seen a million times, basically any time that a movie has been adapted into a TV show. The one that stands out to me is the sort of opening montage to establish the overall story of the La Femme Nikita television show, where...
What?
like if you look at Nikita, the movie, that's a story about a woman who is a junkie, essentially, mm-hmm. who in the middle of a sort of robbery gone wrong from her perspective, she ends up killing a cop in cold blood. She is then sentenced to death but taken by a Secret Service type of agency and groomed and trained into becoming a cold-blooded killer, an assassin for some sort of Section 31 type of government agency. So you think about that as a TV show, and it's like, oh, that could work too. You could do that as a TV show. You could do that as a TV show twice. And, you know, it's like, well, you just have her adventures as a spy, you know, whereas she has a full arc in the movie. You could totally string that out for numerous seasons. And that's what they did. And so when I heard that they were doing this as a show, La Femme Nikita, I was like, oh, right on. I'm going to check that show out. And I watched the very first part of the very first episode where they established that she is not a cold-blooded killer who murdered a cop. She is a woman who happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and was standing by... I don't even think it was a cop that got killed. I think it was just like a woman who got knifed to death. And she happened to be walking by as it happened and picked up the knife. And basically the cops saw her standing over the body and said, oh, you're a cold-blooded killer. We're going to sentence you to death, blah, blah, blah. But by doing that, you establish that, oh, this is a likable character who you can relate to over the course of five seasons on the USA Network or whatever it is. And I really felt like that kind of thing, that clunkiness, was going on in Crash. In the early episodes, you had, like you're saying, a car crash, and you have sort of a same scenario which was set up in the movie with Matt Dillon and Tandy Newton, where this cop was taking advantage of this woman, and then the story kind of spins out from that. And there are all sorts of like very stereotypical race relations, which don't really make any sense, to the point of being almost a cartoon. And it was really, really frustrating. And as the season progressed, after I got about halfway through the season, I started warming up to it because the stuff that didn't involve that actually worked pretty well for me. There were some storylines which were just dead in the water, and there were other storylines which I thought were really interesting and went to really cool places. For example, the Dennis Hopper storyline, the way that it starts off is absolutely ridiculous, just like what you're talking about and all this other stuff. But as it progressed, it changed and grew and became something different. And then by the end of it, you've got Dean Stockwell running around with a scorpion in the desert. And who doesn't like that, really? I mean, honestly, come on. I definitely warmed up to season one over the course of it, so that by the time I got to the end, there were some things in there, like the cop storyline, where I was just like, come on, guys, you're reverting back to your old selves. I mean, the first few episodes are almost unwatchable, but there was a lot of stuff in there which I thought was decent. I don't think it was a great show by any stretch of the imagination, but it was okay. It was definitely better than the movie. And then I started reading about season two. Now, the reaction to season one was not good. It wasn't terrible, but it was definitely tepid. And so were the ratings. And like Ira Stephen Bear was saying, you know, any other network would have canceled it. But for whatever reason, Starz decides to keep it around because, I don't know, Spartacus needs a lead-in? I don't know. They decide to keep it for season two. But they also decide that a substantial reinvention is needed. So first step, they fire Glenn Mazzara. I'm assuming. Maybe he left. I don't know. But he was gone regardless. Now, Ira Stephen Bear says that, you know, there are some lurking variables. You know, he feels that Mazzara is a good writer, but the deck may have been stacked against him, and who knows what other circumstances were involved.
I think the deck was stacked against him when they said, let's make Crash into a TV show.
But maybe. I'm wondering if he went to them or if they went to him. I'm assuming they went to him, but I don't know. So, it's now 2009, and they say, hey, Ira Stephen Bear, do you watch this show Crash? And Ira Stephen Bear says, nope. And they say, oh, well, do you want to run it? And he watches the show and goes back to them and says, okay, yeah, well, you know, you've got some things here that work and some things here that don't. And, you know, if you let me basically keep what elements I want and jettison the ones that I don't, then you could theoretically do this as a good show. So the big thing that he said is that towards the end of the season, it basically became a cop show. And he said that the last thing that TV needed was another cop show. So in order to basically get rid of that storyline completely, he decided that the first thing that needed to be done was to tear down the sets for the police station.
Mm-hmm.
Basically get rid of all the cops. He kept four characters, one of which was Dennis Hopper, and he started the series in season two basically from scratch, so much so that he designed it so that if you had never seen an episode in season one, you wouldn't be lost at all. He introduced a lot of new characters, the big one being Eric Roberts, who plays like a very, very, very wealthy billionaire, who he described as sort of a Bobby Kennedy-like transformative figure, and that he starts off wanting to build a football stadium, and he's in it for the money. Then he has a religious experience, I guess you could say.
He passes out.
He thinks that God has spoken to him. And when he comes out of it, he decides that his mission in life is to basically build a city for the homeless.
Yeah.
His wife is played by Linda Park, by the way, of Enterprise fame.
Nice.
I read an interview with him where they said, hey, did you cast Linda Park because she was on Enterprise? And he's like, nope. I didn't know that she was on Enterprise because I never saw that show.
Yeah.
And they're like, he's like, if I wanted to cast someone from Star Trek, I would have cast some of my DS9 homies.
Yeah.
He even said that he wanted Andrew Robinson to be on it, but he was teaching at that point in time. I'm assuming as the Eric Roberts character. I can't think of who else he would play. And he also talked about how he'd want Jeffrey Combs to be on there because Jeffrey Combs is in like everything that he does, but he couldn't really find a role which suited him.
Are you kidding me? He plays God.
There you go.
He was a head character that whispers to Eric Roberts.
They should have had you on staff.
No.
The other character who they bring in is a younger man who was a former star pitcher in high school, but who blew out his arm and is now running his hobby shop with his mom.
Yeah. I'd like to talk about that, because that guy's plot line made no sense to me. And like, there were points where I was like, do I not get this because I don't know baseball? Or do I not get this because this does not make sense?
Okay, before we get into that, you listen to the ideas that Bear has. You listen to his critique of season one and his ideas for changing it in season two. You listen to him talk about what he has planned for the Eric Roberts character. You hear what he has planned for the show on the whole. The idea, like he says, that it was kind of pitched to him as a Dickensian story, and what writer can turn that down? And you get really excited. I get really excited. I was looking forward to watching this show more than probably, well, I've pretty much seen all the other shows, but more than any other show that I can think of watching right now. I was like, I cannot wait to see season two of Crash. I cannot wait to see Ira Stephen Bear do this on, you know, pay cable with no commercials, with no genre conventions. I am excited to see what he does with this show. And you know, a couple of weeks ago when we were talking to Larry Nemechek and he was telling us about how when Michael Piller gave Bear his script for Insurrection and when Piller came into his office, Bear took off his glasses and mm-hmm. right then and there, Piller knew that he was in trouble.
Yes.
If I were Ira Stephen Bear and Ira Stephen Bear were to come into my office with season two of Crash, I would take off my glasses. I love Ira Stephen Bear as much as anyone can love a television showrunner who they've never met.
Oh, okay. All right, that's good. That's good. I'm glad you put that at the end there because I was going to be like, pretty sure he's married.
But with that being said, everyone has duds, and Crash is Ira Stephen Bear's dud.
I agree. I think that it's unfair almost to say that he screwed anything up. I mean, it's not. I said it before. It's not an idea for a show. It's an idea for a plot device to get more demographic like boxes checked.
Well, but let's talk about that, because what I see in watching Bear's show, in his defense, I see basically the race stuff is gone. You know, he basically got rid of that and decided to just make it about people in different parts of, in different places in life, in different places in society. And
are you ignoring the big, really big, directly dealing with race
the thing at the end?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, he left that out for a good 12 episodes and then went like full throttle in the last one, and then it's just kind of like, okay, whatever. But let's back it up. Let's just talk about the first 12
episodes.
That is a
freaking like flaming red herring from space.
Let's just talk about the first
giant crater.
Let's talk about the first 12 episodes, okay?
Let's focus on the first 12 episodes.
And not
ignore
the last
that
one.
Thing at the end that makes the whole thing look idiotic.
Okay, okay. So he really got away from the race stuff, whereas, you know, like, in season one, it was ridiculous. Like, even to the point of, like, little scenes like a woman hires a contractor, and she's supposed to meet the contractor at her house, and then she walks into her living room, and there's a black guy standing in her living room, and she's like, "Oh, my God, who are you?" And he's like, "I'm the contractor." And she's like, Oh, I didn't expect you to be black, you know?
Yeah, the first season of the show, there were a shocking number of points where I was like, "What's happening? What just happened?" And then, like, someone would say, like a racial story, and I was like, "Oh, racism! I forgot it!" Because, like I don't know, like, I, it doesn't pop in there. Like, my first thought is, like, do they know that guy? That happened a lot.
Yeah,
like I was surprised by the racism every time it appeared, because it always appeared like "Oh, hello, sir. Oh, hello, black man," who I don't like because of blackness. It was really weird every time.
Yeah,
in season two, they kind of edged around it until the end
when
they exploded racism. All over my face.
we'll get to that in a second. But, okay, back it up a little bit. So that's gone. You also have the, you know, crashes, I think, were gone. Although, here's the thing, right? I read a couple interviews with him. I watched an interview with him in regards to Crash. And there's one thing where they were like, "Are the stories going to intersect?" And he's like, "Yeah, they will, of course. That's part of the fun, but we need to be careful with it," or whatever. He's like, "Any time that we have a crash, we need to blah, blah, blah. And these crashes can be fun, but at the same time, you know, they're dangerous because you get into the problem of cliche and stuff like that. And this guy is doing this thing, and this guy is doing this thing. And he's going to crash into them." And he kept on talking about these things as crashes.
Yes.
Like, this is a thing. This is a part of this show. And, I mean, I guess it is, you know? Yes, it's a crash. But any time it happens, it is the most forced, ridiculous thing I've ever seen. And, I mean, there's a one episode where the young guy goes to the billionaire's house because his mom donated $300, which they don't have, and he wants to get it back. Mm-hmm. And the billionaire invites him upstairs, and then there's a citywide blackout. And he basically spends the rest of the episode up in the billionaire's house waiting for the blackout to end. Yep. It doesn't make any sense. It really doesn't. It's ridiculous. And I that kind of thing was just like, man, yeah, if you're burdened with that, that's you. I don't see how you can make a good show. But the thing that really surprised me was that I don't think it was as good as season one. Like, everything that he changed, I thought he changed for the worse. You know, when I first looked at it, I was like, okay, the characters
that's crazy.
I'm like, the characters that he's keeping are the ones that I responded to. You know, Dennis Hopper's character is definitely the best in the show. And his relationship with his driver, his black driver, who wants to be a rapper. Okay, that relationship to me is the best part of that show. So season two, that thing, you know, it ends where it ends. Season two picks up. Dennis Hopper's daughter has been killed, and the entire season is basically him trying to figure out who killed his daughter.
Yeah,
that doesn't work at all. The Eric Roberts thing. The Eric Roberts thing, I think, was okay.
Oh, boy.
But we'll get to that in a second, too.
Oh, boy.
Because that ties into the overall Ira Stephen Bear mythology, I think, a bit. But before we get into that, well, first off, the other two characters who they brought over were two people who had a relationship in season one.
And don't have a relationship in season two.
It was the cop who crashed into the woman, and the woman that he... you know, assaulted, and basically they ended up in a relationship. At the end of the season one, the relationship ends, and the two of them go their separate ways. he becomes a security guard, which makes sense. His progression kind of makes sense. His character is a little weird because he seems completely transformed, whereas in the first season he was a total jackass. In this season, he's one of the most likable characters on the show, so that doesn't really make a lot of sense. But her character is essentially a different character. I mean, she's in a different place in her life. She's acting completely differently, and basically those two people are like the same in that they had these two actors under contract, and by the way, they didn't. I mean, I don't know why they would keep these two. I can kind of see the guy. I can kind of see the woman, too. But it basically is like they are two completely different characters. And I don't think they're as good as the ones in season one.
There's, well, I don't know. Look, the guy, the whole thing with the guy is like, you know, he's done a lot of crazy nonsense, so he gets fired from the police force. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And this crazy woman is no longer involved in his life.
And I guess her life goes to, you know, it gets to a place where basically she's lost everything. So she starts dating basically a very, very low-level con man.
Right, but like both of these people's like lives seem mainly transformed by not being involved with each other's lives.
I guess so.
And that didn't seem like a big deal to me, because like they had a ridiculous relationship, and every time they were on screen together, I thought, this is a stupid scene. This is a stupid scene that I'm watching. I would really like it if they would stop doing this, because this relationship not only is not fun to watch, it has nothing interesting to say. It's really just like, hey, look at these two dysfunctional people being ridiculous. Isn't that dramatic? I don't even know. I mean, is this how a TV show works? That's what I felt coming from the writer's room watching those episodes.
Maybe.
So when they ended that, I mean, like, I could have sent them a gift basket for how happy I was to not see those two characters interacting anymore, because their interactions were idiotic, and their relationship was tedious and boring and stupid, and them not being together, I was willing to accept just about any kind of transformation, because they were primarily defined by their stupid relationship.
Maybe, but I don't know. To me, I didn't have a problem with that, really. I was okay with their relationship. I found it to be rather interesting. But the direction that they put these characters in... Now, I guess the cop I was okay with. But what they did with the woman, I didn't really... I didn't respond to that at all. I don't know. But...
Well.
Moving on to the other new character, which is the former baseball player. WTF.
You mean you don't know what's going on with that guy?
I don't know what's going on with that storyline. What is going on with that storyline?
I was asking you that.
Okay, well, here, let's try to break it down. Here's a guy... He was a baseball player.
No, he's not, because he screwed up his arm.
In high school, he was like on his way to become a major league star. He screws up his arm. Yeah. So he goes and he's running the hobby shop, the failing hobby shop that his dad established, his dead dad established, which now
still,
runs
hobby
with
shop,
his mom.
Fun place to be.
Whatever. So he sees a kid who looks like he has potential on this baseball team. And he basically takes him under his wing to show him, you know, how to make it.
Yeah.
You know, he's trying to basically get a do-over, living vicariously through this kid. So...
Yeah, that's a little...
There's
some sweat on the brow of the writers when that starts happening.
And that's the first thing that happens with this character. So that relationship quickly turns obsessive, and he starts doing things which don't make any sense at all.
Well, the first thing is he's like, you shouldn't hang out with that girl anymore. She's distracting.
Yeah.
And
so he gets the kid to break up with his girlfriend.
Right. Like, that's the first time, like, it seemed odd, and I didn't quite get it. But, like, at the same time, I thought, like, maybe this is a thing?
Well, this
is kind of normal.
Don't forget there was the scene earlier where he's stalking them. He's in his car watching them as they make out on the benches.
Right, but like I don't know what that was. I don't know what was going on there. See, because it would have been easy if I could just say, like,
Is he
a pedophile? Is he in love with this kid?
Well, I read it as jealousy. I don't think that he was a pedophile, but I think that he wanted this kid's attention. He wanted this kid's full attention.
Right. None of it makes sense. None of it holds together in any sort of way that makes sense to me. Because if I say, like he wants to have this kid's life and live vicariously through his success, that doesn't really work because it doesn't really seem like he cares that much about this kid's success.
I think he cared a lot about the kid's success.
Anyway, I couldn't get a bead on this guy because every time I thought I had a handle on it, I was
that's because
no, that doesn't fit.
That's because it kept on spiraling into more and more craziness. You know, the next thing that happens is another star kid comes in whose dad was a major league pitcher, and he starts overshadowing this other guy, and they have a conflict. He wants to, I guess, be cool with these kids. So at first he smokes pot with them.
Yeah.
Then he goes and gets a hooker and has sex with the hooker while the kids watch.
Yep.
Then he buys beer for them. And then that's when the other kid finds this dude's scrapbook of the kid who he's mentoring. And that's when... I think it's at that point that the first kid gets a restraining order, and then he goes and yells at the kid, and the kid's parents beat him up. And then I can't remember if that was before or after he mugs the star pitcher kid's kid and shatters his pitching arm, essentially ending his career.
There's a lot that goes on with this character, and I don't get most of it. But I got the impression that somebody said, "Oh, he's crazy."
Oh yeah,
this is how we explain these bizarre actions.
Halfway through the season, they basically jettison the story with the baseball and decide to shift it to a different form of crazy, where now he's dating a woman, and he's basically. Doesn't know how to deal with a relationship. He's jealous of his mom at one point. His mom is jealous of him. He's very sort of prudish in some ways, but in other ways he's very kinky. And basically everything that he does, you're just like, what? And not in a that's messed up kind of way, although sometimes kind of, but more in a why would you do that kind of way?
Well, this is a character that throughout this run, I would periodically go, I don't know why he's doing this. And because it seemed so, matter of fact, I regularly thought, did I miss something?
but it happens so many times,
Yeah,
and then
no,
they just built on it.
No, it's basically everything he does. Yeah.
And basically what it was leading up to was at the end, he basically is the big catalyst for the final crash. I think we're in agreement that storyline doesn't work at all.
I don't even know what that was. That's sort of the problem. I cannot connect those dots in a logical way. Because it seemed like every time he was on screen, they were saying, hey, what if he had a completely different character motivation in this scene?
It was really weird.
Every single time, it just seemed like I don't know, maybe let's just try it. Let's give him... If he was, constantly, his whole consciousness was, just disintegrating and then being, reabsorbed, by other elements, that would make a kind of sense. If he was just, a boggle... machine with the dice popping around in his head, creating different results.
I mean, I know that they were trying to go with the idea that this guy was sort of emotionally disturbed, probably had some mental disorders, and it's quite possible that a psychiatrist could look at this character and be like, oh, well, obviously what's going on is blank, but it did not read. Like that to me.
There are characteristics. There are behavioral patterns.
Yeah.
This guy was unbelievably dynamic in his madness, because he was always different and always very proactive. Mm-hmm. Like, he was always going out there and like, I'm gonna go do something crazy, and he put his hat on, he like straightened up his tie, and he's like doing a crazy thing today, different than yesterday's crazy thing. And like, it was like really bizarre, because he was like not like locked into any particular dysfunctional behavior. It was like every day he was like, that dysfunctional behavior I exhibited yesterday was kind of cool, but I don't want to repeat myself.
Yeah, so I don't know. So that storyline did not work at all for me at all. I mean, when they started up with the baseball thing and he was like, oh, he's mentoring this kid, I'm like, oh, this is sweet. I like this. I'm totally digging this. I can't wait to see where they go with this baseball storyline. And then he starts going all crazy, you know.
You were hoping that they would stick with the baseball mentoring thread.
I was hoping that you know, like, while all this other stuff was going on,
like season five, when he's like dealing with like curveballs,
like all this stuff was going on, and then this storyline was just going to be like, yeah,
extremely technical baseball training minutia,
right? Like here's the thing: you got to learn how to throw this curveball. You know, your kids can't hit the curve. You know, they have trouble with the curve.
There's an arc where like he might have like sprained his arm, and
right,
like, there's concern that he might like make it to training.
Like following the course of the season, you know, yeah. Kind of like
the stress of starting a baseball career,
right?
And how hard that is.
Man, I totally wish they would have done that. And it like has nothing to do with anything else, except at one point Eric Roberts is like, you know what, I'm not going to build a football field, I'm going to build a baseball field. And they're like, hey, yeah. And then he goes and he gets to play at the baseball field. And that's the big crash at the end.
He gets him, like, as a consultant to, like,
a collision go in, at
like,
home
take a look plate, at the architect's, like, mock-up. And goes like, no, you want the showers a little bit closer.
Yeah.
Because we don't want to, like, walk, like 20 minutes to the showers. It's going to be really nasty at the end of a game.
Right.
That would be a nice crash.
That
would
have been cool. But that's not what they did.
Okay. Just for the record, that sounds just as bad in a completely different way.
I disagree. Okay, so now let's just move on to the big thing which I think ties into Bear's career on the whole, and that's Eric Roberts' storyline. Now, he plays a billionaire. He wants to build a football field. He has he basically blacks out and has a vision and believes that God has spoken to him and has told him that what he needs to do is build a town in which to
build a city?
Build a city for homeless people.
For the dispossessed.
Right. And
that sounds familiar.
And what's interesting is in one of the interviews that I read, Bear was asked how this stuff relates to his genre work, and he's like, well, you know, there's certain things, blah, blah, blah. You know, one of the big things is that I've got characters exploring faith, not religion, but faith. Mm-hmm. And that's something which is obviously apparent in 4400 with Jordan Collier and in Deep Space Nine with Benjamin Sisko.
And Kira and
sure,
a bunch of other people.
And I think it was really interesting to see it here in a non-genre show. Did it work? I don't know. What do you think?
What, you mean Eric Roberts having a weird sort of hallucination that God was speaking to him?
Right.
And God gave him, like, really cryptic messages about, like, his responsibility and his duty to build a city?
Right.
That was a mess. That was a complete mess. And there are lots of different things I could point to, but the main thing that I would point to is that it was completely ridiculous. It was like the most forced crash in the show. It was like, I have no way of getting this crazy millionaire dude involved in like some other character's life. So what if they're just at the same place at the same time, and when he has his blackout, and then he's like, I'm going to inexplicably feel really like bound up with this character's life who I met that one time when I had this near-death experience. Like, it's so, it's infuriating because, like, they had to know, this is really thin. Ira, this is really thin. Seriously. I could not describe to you how thin this is, because we can't see objects that thin.
See, to me, the way that I saw it was, you know, he was probably like, we've got to have a crash. You know, we need to. This is one of the things that the studio is asking for. We need to have a crash.
Yeah.
I think it's ridiculous. You think it's ridiculous. Everyone thinks it's ridiculous. But at least here, and this is how I see it, you're having a crash between an older character and a new character. And by doing that, it's not like you had, you know, the cop crash with Dennis Hopper. You're having the cop crash with someone else, and it happens right at the beginning.
Yeah.
And because of that, I just see that as, let's say, setup. You know,
I'm not gonna harp on that. I'm just saying it's a very forced moment, but it doesn't end there, which is the problem. If it had ended there, that would be one thing. But like this guy decides to carry this character along with his storyline.
Mm-hmm.
Because of what he attributes as divine intervention.
And that's fine, you know, because...
No,
I mean,
that's stupid.
I don't have a problem with that, because if it wouldn't have been him, it would have been another character. You know, you might as well. There is nothing... I mean, there's no reason not to do that. That I don't have a problem with.
If it had been
Dennis Hopper, I'd be like, okay, you know...
But I mean, I guess they said that it wasn't... That it wasn't God, no. But at least for the first episode, this is literal Deus Ex Machina, the writer's saying he has a near-death experience, and then he says, hey, other character, take part in my journey now, that you would not have been able to access otherwise.
If it wouldn't have been him, it would have been someone else. I don't have a problem with that.
It doesn't mean that why would it mean that?
It wouldn't have been anyone else.
It would have been the people that he knows.
Well, fine. Then it would have been the people. Then they would have created. I mean, like we already talked about how, you know, the characters from season one were essentially reinventions of themselves. And
but they're not. it's a forced contrivance. It's a contrivance to get him involved in somebody who is not already in his life, so that he has to reintroduce all the elements of his life, essentially as a means for exposition.
That's fine. I mean, hey, Billy Bathgate, you know, anything, any of these things, it happens all the time. That to me is perfectly reasonable to do. I don't have any problem with that.
That's an incredibly sloppy way of getting characters.
And I don't have any problem with the Eric Roberts storyline either. I think that if there was one storyline in season two which worked for me, it was that one. I don't think it's as good as anything in season one.
The storyline where he thinks that God's telling him to build a city,
mm-hmm.
and it turns out he has a brain tumor.
Yeah.
And he doesn't hear, and then he gets the tumor removed and he doesn't hear God speaking to him anymore.
Right.
But he still builds the city.
Well, because he has that transformation. He has that. I mean, like, to me, that's perfectly reasonable, you know? It's Christmas Carol is what it is.
I'm not saying that it's implausible. I'm saying that there's not a lot going on in it.
Well, I don't think there's a lot going on in it either. I mean, do I think it's good? Nah. I don't know. I mean, but do I think it's, you know, terrible? Nah. It's incredibly thin, but it's definitely the best thing that's in season two, and I think it is interesting to look at that in relation to the rest of Bear's career. So for those reasons, I'd say, hey,
it is kind of funny how similar he is to Jordan Collier.
Yeah, in a lot of ways.
Sort of like Ira had some ideas,
yeah,
still lying around,
yeah.
But they were like all bureaucratic procedural ideas. I'd really like to see someone sign the paperwork for zoning laws.
One last thing. I saw an interview online. It's on YouTube with Bear where he's talking to someone from the Santa Fe Film Festival, I believe it is,
mm-hmm.
where he had participated in a panel about shooting movies and television shows in New Mexico. And it is interesting because the thing which is revealed more than anything else in that interview is that they shot in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, which is really weird considering the fact that the show is all about living in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he even says that in the interview. And one of the things that I love about Bear is that he's so candid. He doesn't really care about image. He's more interested in just the facts.
I think that Ira Stephen Bear has a very natural aversion to being forced into being politically correct.
Yeah. So here he's talking and he's like, they're like, oh, so you shot in New Mexico. What was that like? And he's like, well, when they first pitched me the idea, I was like, I don't think that's going to work, you know, especially since the show is supposed to take place in L.A. And it's all about, you know, he said, like, L.A. is the main character. If that's the what you're saying, then how do you shoot that anywhere other than L.A.? And, you know, he went around, they drove him around. He's like, okay, show me downtown, show me Hollywood, show me, you know, the valley, all this stuff. And he said that as they kept on driving, you know.
This was in Albuquerque.
Yeah. And as they kept on driving, he started getting more and more, I guess, discouraged. Hmm. And it got to the point where it was like, okay, that looks like L.A. Don't pan even a foot to the right or else you'll see a cactus, which isn't supposed to be in L.A., but that right there looks like L.A. And he's like, you know, the other thing is we have, you know, green screen technology, which is amazing. And when I don't know if that interview colored my viewing experience, but while watching it, all I could think of was this isn't L.A. This is Albuquerque. And the green screen shots are horrible. And you can really tell that they stripped the budget down. And it not shooting in L.A., I think, is sort of akin to the prequels being shot in front of green screens instead of in practical sets. Like, I got sort of the same vibe as I did from that. So that was kind of unfortunate. I understand the reasons for it. You know, I mean, you're giving a basically a failing show a second shot. So, of course, you're going to slash budget as much as you can. And that's a good way to do it. But you really felt it on the screen, which was unfortunate.
I hear, like, all of this stuff about, like, shooting and, like budget cuts and how they weren't able to do this and that. That none of that would have been a problem had they... stories,
yeah,
worth watching.
That's true.
That's really the problem. The problem is when your main character is your location, you've screwed up.
Yeah. So, final thoughts on Crash?
Well, we didn't mention it. The show ends with the most ridiculous plot development imaginable.
Which one is that? Because I honestly don't know.
The cult?
Oh, yes, where we finally see Marco.
Yeah.
Is that his name, Marco?
I don't know.
From 4400. So here he plays a Charles Manson.
No, he plays Charles Manson.
Okay.
Like, there's no effort to make this like an original concept. This is the most... They ripped off a thing that happened. They actually ripped off history. I think history could sue.
Yeah.
Because
okay.
It's not clever. Like, they just made a modern-day Charles Manson and his cult. And they gave them, like, the exact same crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, hey, do the exact same thing that they did with the actual people and the actual murders and the actual Charles Manson and the actual girls. Like, all of it is exactly the same. And... amazingly enough, this crash where the guys meet with these cult members, amazingly enough, that was not motivated by like an interaction. They were not already connected. It was literally just another crash.
And what they did was, it was like the entire season, it's like leading up to this thing, and they're doing all these investigations, and they're trying to figure out who killed Dennis Hopper's daughter.
Yes.
And what it led them to in the finale was this. And
yes,
there's this extremely tense crash. And then basically, just as it's about to come to a head, Dennis Hopper walks in and is like, yeah, we were wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, she was shot down over the
Sea of
Japan.
There was a dude, he, but... So these guys actually aren't involved.
It's a MASH reference that no one will get
at all. So
yeah, it's completely idiotic. And
you know what I felt like? I felt like it was, this is what happened. They were like, well, this is a show and it's about race relations and everything. And Bear or whoever was like, oh yeah, totally. You know? And then like, they were doing their thing. They were making their stories, whatever, going throughout their thing. And then the studio or the network was like, hey, what happened to the whole race thing? Don't you guys need to, I mean, that's part of our thing. You guys need to put that in there. And they're like, and then they just were like, okay, final episode. And they're just like, racism.
So your theory was like, Ira Stephen Bear was like, it's like, I got an idea. I'm a dunk this at the end. People will be like, no. Oh, snap, did you see what he did there?
I don't think that that's what it is. I think what it is, it's kind of like, you know, how police have, like, quotas. So at the end of the month, you're more likely to get a ticket because they should have been giving tickets throughout the entire month, but instead they were like, tickets.
So your
and
argument
then, and then
is,
in the
is
last
because
day
there
of
wasn't
the month,
any
like,
racism
tickets.
In season right. two until the end.
He's like,
the
oh,
network
God.
Kept saying, like, look, we need 100 racism points by the end of this season,
yeah,
and you've got, like, maybe like, six.
Right, exactly.
And he's like, all right, I could come up with something that has, like, maybe 94 racisms. And
like, I think that's what happened. That's what I think happened.
See, I think that that's sort of, like, part of the story, because I think that what was actually happening was, like, so what's that racism plot line you got going on for season two? And he's like, oh, I've got something. It's coming. Don't worry about it. I'm cooking it up. I don't want to spoil anything. And then, like, you know, he goes back to his office. He's like, I got nothing.
Right, exactly.
I got nothing. And then at the very end, he's like, dude, what's a crazy racism thing? And like, that guy was just like,
yeah.
I don't know, that Manson thing. And he's like, gold! You're fired. I don't need you anymore.
I mean, I think that is kind of what happened. That's my guess or whatever. I don't know.
Yes.
Because I was really impressed by the fact that they got away from it. Because, I mean, like, I started watching this show, and, like, my wife would be in the room, like, knitting or whatever. And, like, throughout the first couple episodes of season one, she would just walk out and she'd be like, I can't watch this. This is just too stupid.
Yeah.
And she's like, I cannot deal with the racism in this show. And then when season, you know, two started up, I was like, they've really gotten away from that. It's, like, really a different show. And she would actually sit in and watch chunks of season two, you know? And she wouldn't get up and leave. She would actually be interested in what was going on screen. And then it gets to the end, and it's just like, oh, my God. So I really do feel like Bear did not really want to deal with that stuff. He had these stories. He was interested in the people.
Yeah.
He wasn't interested in these themes that have been, you know, beaten to death by a movie and a season of television.
Well, I mean, look, the thing is, the thing that I found really insulting about the movie and the show in a lot of different places, in a lot of different ways, is essentially the idea that racism is solved by people being nice to people of other races.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not how it works. And one thing that I found, like, disturbing about season two is, like, when that cult thing showed up, I was like, this is the only example of dealing with, like, racial tensions. Like, the only significant one. There are little bits here and there. But, like, the only significant one in this season. And what bothered me was that this is not reflective of actual tensions
mm-hmm.
in the nation. Like race, white and black, like tensions have never been about these crazy assholes. Manson, that was an anomaly. It was an outlier. Racism is much more about, like essentially, like, economics and, like, the shape that history creates in lifestyle and the way people live. That's what racism really comes from. And it's never been about, like, white people wanting to kill black people. It's never been about that. That has always been, like, the freak, the weird outlier. And that's not the actual problem. Those are people, but they are not the problem. And by making them the only example, it sort of distracts from the underlying problem, which is that, like, it's really society and history that are the problem here. And like, it can't be resolved by just being nice. Being nice is not the answer. Like fundamental change is the answer. And when you make it about being nice or about being hateful, you're essentially just dodging the main problem, which is history. And that's a problem for me.
All right. So any other final thoughts on Crash? Season 2 in particular?
It's not a good thing. Everything about, like, everything that, like, the show is based on is, like, the kind of basic stuff that should be in any story. Not being so closed into, like, to one particular way of thinking, you know, be more expansive, include more people, more ways of thinking, more lifestyles. That's just part of basic storytelling now. Like, if you're boxed into such a small little category, that's not going to work. Certainly not. Unless you're making a point about how that category is screwed up.
Yeah. For me, I mean, just looking at season 2 in particular, you know, I had high hopes for it, despite the fact, maybe because of the fact that the movie and season 1 were not very good. I was like, oh yeah, see, when your TV show is not working, you call in the big guns. You call in Ira Stephen Bear. I mean, that's what I would do. I would call in Ira Stephen Bear to do any show. If something wasn't working, if something was working, I'd be like, let's bring in Ira Stephen Bear and see what he can do with this. Because even if it doesn't work, he's at least going to have different ideas, and he might just strike upon something cool. And that is something that he's talked about. You know, he said that people were like, you're crazy. This show is a sinking ship. Why are you doing this? You know, it's not, you know, high profile or anything like that. And he's like, well, that's why I like it. Worked for Deep Space Nine. It mm-hmm. worked for 4400. And, you know, I'm going to try it here. And this time it didn't work. But it is that attitude, that, you know, idea of going out on a limb, not doing the safe thing, changing up what already exists, and trying to make something better. You might fail. You might fall flat on your face, which I think he did here. But if you don't do that, you're not going to get things like Deep Space Nine. You're not going to get things like 4400.
I completely agree.
And I am more than willing to accept Crash Season 2 if it means Deep Space Nine. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. I've said on many occasions, I would prefer someone try to do something crazy and fail miserably than for someone to do something well that has been done before. And there's a lot about, like Ira Bear's work on Crash that I think is great. But I think the problem was that, like, it not only was a sinking ship, this was a ship built to sink.
I mean, that's the thing. You know, is it a good show? No. Is it as good as season one? No. It's not.
No,
but you hear hear his ideas.
They're terrible seasons. Quantifying which one's better is kind of absurd. But if you think that season one is better, you're on some kind of incredible drug that they probably manufacture in LA now.
But you hear about, like, what his ideas were. You know, like, identifying the problems and coming up with solutions. That is kind of brilliant. You know, the ideas that he had, the problem is that his solutions didn't work either. But just the idea of, like, yeah, I'm a fixer and I'm going to go in and I'm going to fix this thing. It's like, yeah, he did a good job of fixing the problems which existed. It's just that he replaced them with a whole new set of problems. And, you know, I mean, that happens, but whatever.
Like random baseball character.
Did you catch the Deep Space Nine reference in there where he's talking at one point, he's like talking about how the hobby shop is important because he's like 70% of our customers are adults. And he's going on and he's like, well, you know, you get all these people and they have high stress jobs and they come in and you can just see that they're at peace, you know, and they just want to put these things together because the thing about putting together models is, you know, every piece has its place, you know, and you know how these things fit together and people need that structure in their lives or whatever. This is what he's doing. But as he's going through this little analogy or whatever, he's like, people come in and, you know, I'll sell them thing and it doesn't matter. It could be an airplane or a model car or it could be a miniature of the Alamo.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, hey, the Alamo miniature.
Yes, yeah.
Deep Space Nine.
There was an Alamo miniature on Deep Space Nine.
So Crash Season 2 fits into Deep Space Nine continuity.
Because of the Alamo miniature?
I'm assuming, right? No? Okay.
No?
Anyway.
Definitely no.
Regardless.
Does the Alamo fit into Deep Space Nine continuity? Because it's just a big version of the miniature?
I don't know. Regardless. Okay, I guess my point, my final thought here, my point is that I do not like season two of Crash, but I really like the fact that Ira Stephen Bear tried to do it. And if Ira Stephen Bear were to come in and be like, guess what, guys? I'm doing season three of Crash. I'd be like, all right, I need to sign up for Stars now.
You wouldn't say, hey, Ira.
No.
Hey.
No.
Quick question. Just, you feel free to not answer. Why?
No, I wouldn't do that. Or maybe I would do that because I think his answer would be, well, because I've got another idea. But see, here's the thing, right? The other thing about Bear is I think that he has a good handle on what it is he's doing. And I think the reason why I would be looking forward to season three of Crash is the same reason why I don't think that he would ever do season three of Crash. Do you see what I'm saying here?
I understand what you're saying, but are you aware that what you just said is quite possibly the exact same thing that was wrong with that baseball guy?
No, what I'm saying here...
Utter insanity.
What I'm saying here is the odds of Ira Stephen Bear doing season three of Crash are exceptionally small because, like you're saying, the idea of trying to make that work again is ridiculous, which is why I don't think he would ever attempt it. Which is also why, if he were to come in and say, I've got an idea for season three of Crash, I'd be like, I want to hear that idea because I am dying to see what it is you came up with in order to make it work.
That is exactly what I'm saying when I say that I want a Star Trek movie to be based on a piece of the action.
All right. Well, we will discuss that on Standard Orbit in a couple weeks, hopefully. Well, it has been fun talking about Crash this week. But that's not the only thing we're talking about on Trek FM. So take a look at what else is going on around the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Romulans on TOS.
To be fair, maybe their visual communications were on a different codec. Maybe the original Earth ships were using Skype and the Romulans were using Google Plus.
Earl Grey.
Generations with Standard Orbit.
And again, I don't know if Mike and Drew would say that Kirk is at his best or not.
No, he's not. But Chekhov is on point.
The Ready Room.
Affliction and Divergence.
Yeah, the other interesting thing about that, though, is to compare the Klingon ethics with the Section 31 ethics, right? Because there are, like you said, there are some groups within the Klingons who maybe don't feel exactly the same way. But then there's this group within the humans who feels completely different. And you kind of wonder what the Klingons think maybe about someone who wouldn't do this.
The orb.
Implications of genetic enhancement.
There's just a danger that you're going to become like the lower rung of society. And only the people whose parents have the money to enhance them are going to be those who have good lives.
To the journey!
Voyager Season 2 Marathon.
So he starts searching frantically for clues as to what happens when this small rock gets thrown at him. So he kind of ducks, pulls out his phaser, gets ready, and another stone comes flying through, and guess who's throwing it?
It's gotta be the monkey.
Of course it is! Thank you!
Commentary, Trek Stars.
The 4400.
You're describing a scenario in which we watch something and laugh hysterically that people all around us, everyone we know, will watch us react to this in this way, and they would say, what is wrong with you two?
Warp 5.
Xenophobia and the Coalition of Planets.
Justification in his mind is that the Vulcans were observing us. They knew the war was happening. They didn't do anything to stop it. But, you know, it really wasn't the place of the Vulcans to step in and stop World War III.
Literary Treks.
James Swallow, The Poison Chalice.
Everybody in this story is dragged into a situation they don't want to be in. And that's kind of where the title, The Poison Chalice, originally came from, is the idea that, you know, Riker is given this promotion, which on paper sounds like a really great idea, but it's a poison chalice. You know, it turns out that it's not what he thought it was. And in fact, you know, he's being dragged into something that he doesn't want to be involved in.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows to get in on the daily Trek Talk. We have new shows for you every day, and you'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can stream and download files directly from the website. Just visit trek.fm/pd for a podcast directory to get all the links. Okay, so, you know, I know that we were going to talk about David Copperfield, but since, you know, now that I'm discussing it and everything, and, you know, we talked about the whole Dickensian thing, mm-hmm. and I really do see Eric Roberts' character as going through sort of a Ebenezer Scrooge-like transformation. So perhaps we should talk about that instead. A Christmas Carol, which is another Charles Dickens story. We can talk about David Copperfield, too. Why not? You can get both of them on audible.com. A Christmas Carol, you can get as read by Tim Curry, which is amazing. So yeah, on, if you go to audible.com, you can download David Copperfield, unabridged, 33 hours and 53 minutes. Or, if you're looking for something a little bit shorter, A Christmas Carol, which is, you know, around
3 hours. Everyone knows A Christmas Carol backwards and forwards.
Well, then let's go with David Copperfield. They've got a million versions of it. You can get one here for $1.39 as read by Peter Batchelor. You can get tons of Charles Dickens stuff, and you can see how that stacks up to Crash Season 2.
David Copperfield makes Crash look like House Party 2.
And you can get it for free since you're a listener to Trek FM. So yeah, just go to audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read, but never thought you'd have the time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks, with more than 150,000 titles to choose from, and new titles coming every week. From classics to current bestsellers, Audible has something for everyone. As a Trek.fm listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. So give it a try today. Catch up on all those classic books you've yet to read, or the latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we thank you and Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and Trek.fm. You could also get A Tale of Two Cities. You could see what happens in between that first line and that last line that Shatner reads in Star Trek II. And
okay.
You could also get Casino Royale, which is the book that Paul Haggis adapted into the second best Bond movie ever. It's actually very true to the book. Very good book. You can get that on Audible, too.
Okay. The second best Bond movie ever?
Yeah, after Skyfall.
You think Skyfall is better than Casino Royale?
You're the only one who doesn't.
Skyfall is stupid.
Yeah, you're the only one who thinks that.
Okay.
As always, you can find us at Trek FM, where we do this show, and I also do Standard Orbit with Drew. You can find us doing Commentary Track Stars Off Topic with our friend Brandon on CommentaryTrackStars.com. Mm-hmm. You can email us at comtrackstars@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter at comtrackstars. And we'll be back next week with Brandon, our co-host on Off Topic, to discuss Ira Stephen Bear's sixth television show, Alphas.